Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The debate over the right way to respond to homelessness reached a new breaking point in Sacramento. The county's top prosecutor, District Attorney Ten Ho, is suing the city of Sacramento over its homeless enforcement. The civil lawsuit says the city allowed, created, and enabled a public safety crisis regarding our unhoused. California accounts for a third of the county's homeless population, but Sacramento County is an outlier, experiencing a 67% increase from 2019 to 2022. To compare, during that same time period, Los Angeles saw a roughly 4% rise, and San Francisco actually dropped by 3.5%. This lawsuit is an escalation months of tension between the county and the city. The mayor is currently out of the country. He's on assignment by the governor touring prison reform in Norway, but in a statement says in part that the frustration that members of our community feel is absolutely justified. But the DA's lawsuit will not clear a single sidewalk nor get a single person off the streets. We're working every day and night to enforce our laws, to provide relief to our community, while avoiding the futile trap of just moving people endlessly from one block to the next. So with that, we welcome Sacramento County District Attorney Ten Ho with more on what this lawsuit may accomplish. Good morning, District Attorney.
Good morning, and thank you for having me back on your show again.
Yep, look forward to having the conversation. You held a press conference yesterday. It was widely covered, so I don't want to rehash what was said yesterday. In the spirit of this conversation, I just have questions regarding your press conference from yesterday, and I know I'm not alone in that. So this is your first year as District Attorney, but you have been with the Sacramento District Attorney's Office for years, so you have seen firsthand the rise in homelessness in Sacramento County. When did you begin thinking about this lawsuit?
So first of all, I've been a prosecutor for 23 years, been a prosecutor here in Sacramento for almost 20 years. And really, approximately 3 years ago, we started to see the significant rise in our homeless and unhoused population. And in fact, that number, when you look at a seven-year period, has increased by 250%. And when I'm out in the community and I oversaw our community prosecution team, the top issue that we were facing was our unhoused crisis for those that live on the streets and those that live in homes. It's not compassionate for anybody or safe for anybody.
The city attorney, in response to the lawsuit yesterday, says that the city has been trying to work with your office multiple times over this year. Why not work with the city longer?
Well, you know, we've always worked with the city. We continue to work with the city over the years. The issue is there is a difference in philosophy in terms of enforcement of the law. When you look at the last year, and the city attorney sent me an email in which they admitted that over the last year, there's not been a single citation and prosecution for any of the unhoused ordinance, such as the sidewalk obstruction, such as the unlawful storage. And the city claims that they have been able to obtain voluntary compliance. And to that, I would say, if anybody believes that there has been voluntary compliance, walk down C Street, walk down Alhambra, walk down Commerce and Bannon and Auburn in the middle of the night, barefoot, alone, and come back and tell me if there has been voluntary compliance. And that's really the fundamental difference there. We've prosecuted, you know, 11,000 misdemeanors last year, and we continue to do it and work in a fair and balanced way. But we have to have all of our partners continue to have enforcement of the law in a fair and equal way that is balanced and that is compassionate.
So we all know that shelter space does not meet the current population of individuals experiencing homelessness on any given night in Sacramento County. There's 2,600 beds throughout the county. Within the city, there's roughly 1,200 beds. So where do they go if they can't be in encampments or on the street?
Well, first of all, I'm a believer that we need to have more affordable housing and more shelter, more treatment beds. In fact, I am a supporter of Governor Newsom's bond to add 10,000 additional mental health beds, a proponent of changing our conservatorship law and our Mental Health Services Act, all of that. But in the short term, how do we deal with the chronically unhoused? And the chronically unhoused are those that have been homeless for more than a year. In that subset, and our unhoused population is not monolithic, but in that subset, 9 out of 10 women in that subset are victims of sexual assault. 8 out of 10 of the chronically unhoused suffer from mental health and drug addiction. So how do we, in the short term, encourage and help people get into treatment and services? when Sheriff Cooper, and they've done a lot in terms of the homeless outreach team, went out and contacted those in the chronically unhoused area, they refuse services and refuse shelter. So if we have, and at the DA's office, we have a program called the CORE program. And it's similar to what I'm advocating for on a greater scale, the Haven for Hope model, which is people who commit multiple nonviolent offenses, instead of going to jail, they can go to treatment. And if they complete that treatment, they never do a single day in jail. We don't want to criminalize homelessness. We want to deal with the underlying issues of mental health and drug addiction.
Hmm. When you mentioned that survey that was, I believe, done by the sheriff's office that reported that 9 out of 10 women who are unhoused, they experience sexual assault. How does potentially penalizing those on the street or without housing, how does that get them into stability and safety?
Well, first of all, we go back to the other statistic I mentioned, 8 out of 10, substance abuse, mental health disorder. So if we can use the intervention from law enforcement, the intervention from our criminal justice system, like a CARE Court model or the Haven for Hope model or what we do with the CORE program, we're able to stabilize individuals in terms of their mental health and drug addiction, which they are using oftentimes to deal with the trauma, whatever trauma they've had in their lives. So now let's get them off the streets. Let's stabilize them, give them the shelter, give them the treatment, and then get them into transitional housing. But we can't do any of that unless we have the enforcement and the compliance on the short-term level to help them get into that. And so it starts there, first and foremost. And that's what I've been disappointed in regards to the city's lack of enforcement and compliance, which I've seen and experienced in being on the ground with our prosecutors, with our law enforcement, with our providers. I see that.
Hmm. When it comes to mental and behavioral health, when you're talking about addiction, I mean, that really comes from the county. The county is an umbrella of the city. The county has a larger budget. It is responsible for those type of services. So why not sue the county and not just the city of Sacramento?
And I've been asked that question many times. And what I've seen here in the last year firsthand is that on the county level, with the sheriff and the homeless outreach team, they're going out there and conducting compliance, but outreach. I also have seen that the county is on par to add anywhere between 300 and 500 additional beds by the end of the year. They've hired multiple behavioral navigators that are actually going out embedded with the city. So they are with the city, going in there at the direction of the city, where to go, how to do the outreach. The problem is when they go in the city and conduct that outreach with the city, those that are in the chronically unhoused subset are refusing the services and the shelter. You know, and I remember at one point, about a year and a half ago, actually going to, and a lot of people don't know this, I was up in San Francisco with Assemblymember Jim Cooper, who's now our sheriff. And we were speaking with a gentleman by the name of Tom Wolf, who talked about how he got addicted to fentanyl, ended up sleeping in the alleyway in the Tenderloin. And Tom was telling us that when he was under the influence of fentanyl and somebody came up and asked him, hey, here are the services available, here's what you can do, he said, I ignored them because they were interfering with my high. And so I said, Tom, how did you get off the streets? He says, look, what happened was I was arrested for carrying what we call dope, drugs for these dealers over here. And I ended up in jail. I got a chance to sober up and was able to get my life back on track with treatment. And so before we can get to the services that you're talking about with the county, we need to have the enforcement and the compliance first so that we can help encourage those individuals to get that. Instead of doing jail time, I want people to get treatment and services. That's what we need to do to deal with the underlying issues.
But by criminalizing them, doesn't that dig them into a further hole to get out and even get into affordable housing?
Well, you have two different options. One is you do nothing, in which case they stay where they are, like Tom was, and they continue in that state. You know, we talk about insanity. Insanity, one of the definitions, doing the same thing over and over again without any success, and yet you keep doing it. What we're doing here is insanity. We need to break that cycle of addiction and get them into the treatment. And It's not criminalizing individuals because we're giving them the opportunity, the encouragement. And that's what drug court used to be, is to get people in there to try to get them the treatment, the help they need. And so there is a place for it. There is definitely a place for that we're trying to do.
Yeah, as I mentioned, California is home to roughly a third of the country's unhoused population. That has been a sticking point with Republicans that criticize Democratic policies in the state. Are there politics involved in this? I mean, do you think Democrat-led policies, we are a Democrat supermajority, have failed in response to homelessness?
This isn't about politics. It's about public safety. It's not about partisanship. It's about public safety. You know, in the stories that I talk about, and, you know, it's on both sides. I mean, I saw a woman recently on the corner of J and 15th Street where she was, you know, 100 degree weather, barefoot, unhoused, hopping on a sizzling sidewalk. I've seen people in the rain wrapped up in blankets in the wintertime. I've seen people suffering a mental health breakdown, their pants halfway down. It's not compassionate for people to living in conditions consistent with third world countries. On the other side, I have people who are afraid to walk their children to the park. Little girls can't play soccer on a field because of broken needles. So where do we draw that balance for both the housed and the unhoused? Whatever it is we're doing now and whatever we've been doing is not working. So let's try something. Let's work it. And so am I shaking things up? Absolutely. But I think we need to move the needle in the right direction.
If this lawsuit is successful, what does it accomplish?
What it does is I've asked for several things. First of all, the lawsuit, nobody's asking for money. We want what we call injunctive relief, which is that the court mandates that the city do certain things. Number one, consistent enforcement, all right, that is fair and across the board to everyone, that is balanced and compassionate, but you have to enforce the law in regards to the ordinances. Number two, we need to add additional safe ground sites as well that are professionally run. When you have multiple encampments that are spread out, it's really difficult to give concentrated services. So let's have safe ground sites that are professionally run. I've advocated that from the beginning. The other thing is we need to have a real-time date access to shelter bed availability that is available to everyone, all the partners, including law enforcement. And it's a model down that they have in San Diego. So these are some of the proposals that I have. I listed them in a letter that I sent to the city on August the 7th. You can find that on the DA's website at sacda.org.
Have you talked with other district attorneys? I mean, I think this is the first of its kind, a county suing, you know, its own city. I mean, is this a response that you think other local governments may take?
You know, other prosecutors, other leaders have spoken to me about it, and they've asked the legal theory and the reasoning behind it. But really, it comes down to every specific community, because every community has different needs. This is a local crisis, in my opinion, created by local decisions and indecisions. This is a local issue. And so, you know, what works here in Sacramento doesn't work here, may not work for other communities. And really, I'm here as, you know, a resource for anybody that has questions, but it's really a local issue.
You mentioned that there's a lot of compassion behind this litigation. You know, what do you say to grassroots, nonprofits, community organizations? They operate on small, shoestring budgets. They have a great deal of compassion for people who are unhoused, and they oppose this lawsuit. They think it's not the right step.
You know, there is a, what I believe is this. I've never questioned anybody's capacity for compassion or anyone's intention. I may disagree with a particular approach. At the end of the day, we all want to get to the same place, to get people off the streets, the treatment, the health they need, the transitional housing, all of that. And if we can, on the front end, stop homelessness, let's do that as well. I'm a believer in affordable housing, but we need to, you know, come together, because whatever it is that we're doing here is not working. And I think that everybody agrees that whatever it is we're doing here is not working at all. In fact, we are regressing, and that's not fair to the people in the street. So I have great respect for our nonprofits, you know, our community-based organizations. They do amazing, amazing work, and I'm a big supporter of them as well. I just believe that in order to get to that space, we need to have some compliance with the law, these proposals, and let's get to the right place.
Yeah, there's a lot of passionate views about solving this, and they can conflict with each other. I go back to the first time you joined us on Insight when you were DA-elect, and you shared your own lived experience. You and your family fled communist Vietnam, you know, in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. You were 5 years old. You arrived in Stockton. You didn't even have a mattress to sleep on. You overcame poverty and language barriers to become one of the few Asian American DAs in the country. How does that shape your approach to homelessness in California?
You know what? I know what it feels like to be hungry. I know what it feels like to wear the same pair of shoes when you're a little kid and, you know, it doesn't fit anymore. I know how it feels to be down. But I also know that this country has a tremendous capacity for compassion and to help each other. And we may disagree on how to get there, but being on your show and listening and really listening to other people, there's a lot of great ideas. We may not all agree on those ideas, but we can talk about it. We can learn from each other. And the idea here is let's move forward and do something different than what we're doing. And at the end of the day, we all have great compassion, but that compassion needs to be balanced. And let's find a way out of this. And we can, and we will.
Sacramento County District Attorney Tin Ho, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much.
As I mentioned, we reached out to the city and Mayor Daryl Steinberg. Both were not available, but we do have their statements on our Insight page as well as our homepage of capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A quarter of children in Sacramento County live in single-parent homes, and the impacts can have long-lasting effects on both parent and child. The county's Be Healthy Sacramento says children of single-parent households are at higher risk for emotional and behavioral problems and even have higher morbidity rates. That's why a few years ago, a single parent opened a nonprofit resource center in Sacramento called Single Mom Strong. The mission is to help other women by providing a space to connect, learn, or even just take a breather. Since its opening in 2016, Single Mom Strong has helped hundreds of parents, and now they're offering new services to further their impact. Tara Taylor is the founder of Single Mom Strong and is joined by parent Megan Gillini. Thank you both for coming to Insight. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tara, I want to start with you. This was your idea. When were you compelled to open a nonprofit like Single Mom Strong?
Well, I raised my daughter alone. I got married and divorced very young and was solo parenting for most of her lifetime. And what I thought was interesting was despite professional success, despite having income available to support her, it was still really challenging. So I thought when she left for college that perhaps I could use my business experience and my life experience combined to make a difference.
What was lacking in that experience as a single mom yourself that you're filling now with Single Mom Strong?
Most importantly, connection. I was really unsupported on my journey. And, you know, it really does make a difference to have someone to bounce ideas off of, parenting strategies off of, or just, you know, share when you're having a hard day or those kinds of things. So I think the loneliness and connection to counteract that loneliness is really important. So most importantly, Single Mom Strong is a community of single moms. They're joined by the commonality of, you know, carrying all those balls in the air at the same time. And that lived shared experience really bonds them and they're able to lean on one another.
Yeah, when reading your bio, I mean, you had a successful career. I mean, you worked incredibly hard to provide a life for your child that, you know, typically would be provided by two parents. I mean, you write about that in your bio. But what I'm hearing from you is that what was missing was, you know, that connection and that support from other people going through the same thing.
Absolutely. And you know, that is what provoked my effort, because we think that money or resources are a solution and they aren't necessarily. So most importantly, we need others. You know, it really does take a village. That is cliche, but it's true. And so I saw certain things show up in my child that despite all of my effort, I still couldn't be a father. I still couldn't be, you know, a two-parent household. And so I wanted to figure out ways to maybe, you know, change that for children as they are growing up in the future.
Yeah, Megan, I see you nodding along. When, how did you become connected with Single Mom Strong?
Yeah, I found SMS on Facebook 4 years ago, and immediately after joining, I was welcomed. I wasn't sure if I was the right type of single mother to qualify for to be part of the group since I was divorced. But Tara quickly let me know that all single mothers are welcome, no matter our journey to single motherhood. So,
yeah. In that time, how has this nonprofit helped you and your family?
There's been so many ways that I've benefited from being a part of Single Mom Strong. One of the ways is my children and I have taken part in multiple events, and those have included bounce houses and rope training courses and picnics in the park, and just really feeling like we are part of a community. And I've made some incredible high quality friendships with women that probably I may not have encountered in my daily life otherwise. Some of the other examples are I've participated in Mother's Day Out events, and those are just opportunities where we can have fun and develop those friendships and just feel like something part of a larger and group, and we can be stronger together than any one individual.
Yeah. Oh, what I'm hearing from you is that it helped fill, you know, a void for you personally as a mom, but you also see it be transformative for your children as well.
Yeah, they've participated in some of the summer camps, and they've also, you know, developed friendships with some of the friends' kids that, you know, I've met over the years. And they also saw how SMS helped us when my father was ailing in 2019. He was living with us. And Single Mom Strong developed a meal train. And moms that I didn't even know, which completely touches my heart, came by and dropped off meals. And it just really means so much to us. I absolutely love this organization.
Yeah, Tara, I can imagine, you know, Megan is just, you know, one of many people who would agree with Megan that are part of Single Mom Strong, because, you know, when you're so busy just trying to get basic needs met and there's only 24 hours in the day, that can really catch up on you and you don't really get that breather.
Absolutely. We all need somebody to lean on, right? And you know, single parenting, no one sets out, or very few people set out to be a single parent. You arrive here for a variety of different reasons, but all parents want the same thing. They just want the best for their children, right? And so it's really important that we have the resources to be able to allow us to be a good human being first, the best version of ourselves, and then we can be the best version of ourselves as a parent. So we try to instill that. We create opportunities for our moms to, you know, our Moms Night Out event, for example, we have free childcare on site, and then they'll go to a concert or an escape room, or, you know, just take a few hours to be a human being first and refill their own cups, so then they can go on and do their best as a parent.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're learning about a single parent nonprofit that is called Single Mom Strong. Okay, Tara, you have some new programs and resources for your members and clients. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so we started the organization back in 2016, 2017 as the community first, right? Because that's what we knew was most important. But then there seemed to be these themes that were recurring amongst all families, certain things, barriers to success that were really created issues that could be avoided. And so I started to look at what programming can we create that will maybe remove those barriers and allow our single moms to thrive. I see our single mothers as determined. They have grit. They have great work ethic. And so if we just remove those barriers, could they really, you know, do well for themselves and their families? So the first and most important, I think, is quality preschool and childcare that is affordable on a single income budget. That is a challenge for everyone. Childcare is the equivalent of basically a mortgage payments. You're doubling your major expenses. expense every month when you have a child under the age of five. And then, you know, things like school closures, there's President's Week now, right? So what do you do when you're a working single parent when there's all of these days that school is closed? So we really looked at that and thought this is an opportunity for us to create a solution to a really large problem that, you know, again, it's 26% of our kids are in this environment. Mm. Yeah, so Empower Me Preschool and Childcare is our preschool childcare program.
You broke up a little bit, but please continue.
Yeah. So our preschool childcare program is about 30% lower cost than others in the region. We also create opportunities for our moms to volunteer in exchange for additional discounts. And then the programs are really catered to meet the needs of children of single parents. We understand, as we were talking about earlier, Vicky, that there's only so many hours in the day, right? So mom has to come home from work, make dinner, do bath time, do all of these things. We also understand that the more books that are read to a child, the more there's a direct correlation with that child's success. So in our environment, we make sure we read more books than in any other environment every single day. So we're kind of closing that gap. So just really intentional about meeting those needs. That was the first and biggest program that kind of put our programs on the map. Another thing that we see is single moms get trapped in low-wage roles, typically because they're working around a child's school schedule or a childcare arrangement. And so we've now created some workforce development programming to support single moms specifically. There's three parts to our programming. The first is pre-employment coaching. So our moms have the opportunity to have a one-on-one session with a local executive that really makes that conversation specific to the single parent and her needs. It could be resume review, mock interviewing, just talking about how to change industries or change careers. Then we couple that with a career clothing closet. So our moms can shop the closet for free. It has prepared to, you know, clothe themselves properly for an interview or a first day on the job. And that really lends to their confidence. And then the last piece is our career exploration events. And those give single parents information and access to industry with low entry barrier to entry, but high income potential. So like manufacturing or skilled trades, things where women can potentially increase their income and increase their career trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, that is, I mean, that you just kind of laid out a whole curriculum there, Tara, which is amazing. In the last minute or so we have, Megan, I mean, I'm just curious, what have you taken advantage of during your time with Single Mom Strong?
Well, I've taken advantage actually of the pre-employment coaching during the pandemic. I found a need to change positions and find more stable employment. And so I hadn't interviewed for 9 years, so I was a little bit nervous, and I used SMS's pre-employment coaching to get helpful feedback on my resume and do a mock interview. And, you know, within a few months later, was able to secure a position where it's been really beneficial for my family.
I imagine your life would be a lot different if you didn't come across this nonprofit on Facebook.
Oh, yes. Very much so. Very much so. I wouldn't have the high quality friendships. And, you know, Tara's provides wonderful life coaching as well to single moms. I know many friends have taken advantage of that, too. So I love being part of this community.
Megan and Tara, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Tara Taylor is the founder of Single Mom Strong, a nonprofit offering support and resources to single parents in Sacramento. And Megan Gallini is a parent as well as a client. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Of the nearly 10,000 people experiencing homelessness on any given night in Sacramento County, roughly a third are women, and 15% are families with children. We know these numbers have spiked to a record in recent years, but the issue of homelessness has long been part of our community, which means there are organizations who've been providing support and resources to the most vulnerable during their darkest moments. One of those is Women's Empowerment. The nonprofit has been helping unhoused women and their children for more than 20 years. Support that includes career readiness, health resources, child development, and tools to regain stable housing. This week, they are celebrating their latest graduating class at the Transformation Gala, and there is opportunity for you to chip in and help as well. Lisa Culp is the Executive Director of Women's Empowerment and joins us now. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Vicki. Thank you.
Let's go back 22 years ago.
22 years.
Why did Women's Empowerment begin?
Women's Empowerment began as a program of Mary House at Loaves and Fishes. And I was working there, and I kept hearing the same stories from women about how grateful they were for survival services, but how they wanted a pathway out of homelessness for themselves, but mostly for their children. And I had just returned from working 10 years in Nicaragua, and I couldn't understand why there were so many women and children homeless in Sacramento. Because in Nicaragua, despite the war, there were no homeless children. There were no homeless families. And so I started holding focus groups with the women, and they came up with a blueprint of what would help them get back into housing, get a job, and make sure their children had opportunities that they didn't have. And so my job was to go out into the community, get people who could help teach the skills that they needed, and help build that confidence so that they could get a job and create a healthy lifestyle and regain a home for themselves and their children.
And in that time, you've helped more than 1,700 women, 3,700 children in the Sacramento area, and they're called graduates. In what ways does your nonprofit help?
So the initial program is a 9-week job readiness and empowerment program. They learn to suit up and show up every day. We provide on-site childcare. We provide transportation assistance, and we provide a professional clothing closet. So during those 9 weeks, they really begin to change the way they see themselves. We actually have storytellers come in, and they tell a story, and then they ask them who they relate to in that story. And at the beginning of the 9 weeks, they relate to the victim in that story. And understandably, 86% of the women who come to Women's Empowerment have experienced domestic violence. Most of them experienced abuse as children. So then they come back towards the end of the 9 weeks, and they tell another story. And they ask the women, who do you identify with? And at that point, they identify with, you know, the protagonist, the author, who can climb any mountain and ford any stream. And they, at that point, write their own biographies. On the walls of Women's Empowerment, we have the biographies of women of history, but we also have the biographies of 1,837 women. It's pretty amazing.
Down to the last digit.
That's right. And over 4,000 children.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, given that, I mean, we've had this conversation multiple times, including at the start of this show, when it comes to the number of individuals that are experiencing homelessness and are unsheltered, it has reached a record in Sacramento. How does this demand change the work that you do?
A couple of years ago, 3 years ago, pre-COVID, women could get entry-level jobs and afford an apartment. Now they need to make $32 an hour and have a credit score of 640 to qualify for a one-bedroom apartment. So seeing that, it became very clear that we can't just prepare women to get a job. They have to get a career that has upward mobility. And so we began choosing employer partners that were both recession-resistant, because so many women got laid off during COVID, but also had upward mobility so that women could afford housing. And the third piece of that was we have just launched our own transitional housing program. We have 24 absolutely adorable freestanding cottages in a gated community with gardens, and the women who are living there are working. And so they've got 2 years to increase their income, rebuild their credit, begin a savings account, and be ready to enter market rate housing.
Mm. Wow, that's incredible. I mean, when you talk about the barriers to even getting into a one bedroom apartment, and these are not only just women, but also women with children as well, and what you need to make an hour, $32 an hour, which is, you know, more than double what the minimum wage is.
That's right.
You also make a point on your nonprofit's website. You include trans women and people who identify as non-binary. Mm-hmm. How has the need for these residents, how has that changed and grown and evolved in the more than two decades you've been part of this?
When I first began, we had no trans women, no non-binary women who were coming. We have strong partnerships with two of the organizations who work. You know, one's a shelter that works with women who are living with HIV or AIDS. And, you know, the other is the LGBTQ Center. And we really make it clear that this is a place where they're welcome. You know, if they identify as a woman, they are welcome at Women's Empowerment. One of the appeals that we sent out focused on one of these women, and we got so much really good feedback that people were really pleased to see how our community can be inclusive rather than exclusive.
Mm. You know, we're talking about largely about the women, the adults that are part of your program, but there's also children mm-hmm. as well. What services are offered for them?
So we have a beautiful child development center, and we have a partnership with First Five and Help Me Grow. So we do developmental assessments with the children, because children who are experiencing homelessness are four times more likely, even than children living in poverty but who have a home, to experience developmental delays. And we want to catch that early, because if you can catch it early, you can begin to respond to it, and it won't have the same degree of impact. Mm-hmm. It's so incredulous to me that children start off school behind. So we identify what those developmental milestones are or where their delays are, and then we put together an individualized play plan so that the teachers, the parents, the volunteers who come in and work with the children in the child care know what they really need to focus on with the children so that they can meet those developmental milestones. And if by the end of the 9 weeks they haven't, we do a warm handoff to an organization that really can continue to work with the mother and the child.
Mm. I imagine, you know, when you're talking about what has changed and what has become increasingly difficult after COVID, prior to, like, you know, 2019, you also see that taking shape with the children that you're serving.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. So many families, you know, earlier in the program, they were talking about chronic homelessness being anybody who's experienced homelessness for over a year. Well, I can tell you how many people are experiencing homelessness for the first time since COVID. So even though they're considered chronically homeless, they have not been homeless chronically. They have lost their job, and they have not had the resources to get out of homelessness. You know, as you mentioned, there are no shelter beds. There's no room in the domestic violence centers. There's no beds in the treatment centers. Where do they go? What do they do? And so we've really begun to do a lot of street outreach, because it takes a lot of courage to, once you've been out on the streets, to walk into an organization because you've been turned down so many times saying you don't fit, you're not right, go here, go there. So our job is always to screen the women in and make sure our services meet their needs. Mm-hmm. Once they graduate, they have services for as long as they need. We provide paid training. We provide certification programs. We provide tuition assistance if they're going back to school, because we want them to continue We want that not just that they are no longer homeless, but that their children aren't homeless. We want multi-generational transformation.
And all of this work, these programs and services, it culminates in a celebratory way with this Transformation Gala, which is later this week. It's on Thursday. Tell us about it and how listeners can help if they have the means to.
Absolutely. So our gala is our annual celebration. We have four graduations each year, and we just had one last Friday. But it's really the opportunity to honor and celebrate the success, not only that the women have achieved, but they know they didn't do it alone. They know that there are hundreds of volunteers that have been part of their team and supported them in being successful as teachers, as mentors, as people who work with their children in the Child Development Center, as employer partners, as training partners. And so it's an opportunity for the community to come together and to really celebrate what the transformation that is possible when a community unites. Mm. And 50 graduates are invited each year from the last year's graduates. And we obviously just invite them to come as our guests. And then we hope that the community will sponsor one of the graduates or two of the graduates to come.
With their ticket.
With their ticket. So that this can actually be a fundraiser also.
Wonderful. Well, Lisa, thank you so much. And I know Thursday is going to be a great evening. An emotional one.
But an emotional one.
Good feelings.
And thank you for being our MC.
Happy to do so. Lisa Culp is the Executive Director of Women's Empowerment. The nonprofit has been helping women and their children experiencing homelessness for the past 22 years. This Thursday is their Transformation Gala, and they're looking for people to sponsor tickets. So if that sounds like you, we have more information on our Insight page. And with that, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.